I'm Dave Jackson, cryptocurrency and blockchain editorial writer here at StockHouse.com. This is episode 2 in our series of Blockchain Cryptocurrency 101 podcasts. Our mission going forward is to help listeners and investors navigate the sometimes murky waters of blockchain technology and digital currency. Today, we're very excited to be joined by one of the blockchain industry's most respected and experienced names, Andrew Kiegel, President and Chief Executive Officer at Hut 8 Mining Corporation, a leading worldwide cryptocurrency mining and blockchain infrastructure company based in Toronto, Canada. Mr. Kiegel has extensive experience in providing investment banking services to numerous public and private entities. With more than 18 years in the real estate and retail capital markets groups, including most recently as Managing Director Investment Banking, as well as key member of GMP's Blockchain Investment Banking Group. Thanks for joining us, Andrew.
Thanks for having me.
So, Andrew, could you just start off and maybe just give us a brief background bio of yourself and, you know, how you initially became interested in blockchain technology?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dave. So as you mentioned, I was an investment banker, my last place for more than 18 years. And for a long time, I was focused on what we would call more traditional areas such as real estate. And my interest in blockchain came about a year ago when I was exploring the use of blockchain and how that might tie into things such as real estate. So, mm-hmm. you know, are there ways of tying pieces of real estate to the blockchain ledger for validation purposes. Then as part of that, I was one of the people that started the blockchain team at GMP. And, you know, while there, we raised equity probably in excess of $800 million over the course of 2017 for various blockchain entities.
Now, blockchain, Bitcoin, crypto mining, they're all terms that are now becoming part of the mainstream tech lexicon. What is it, and really what's driving all the hype right now?
Yeah, so I think in order to sort of see where we are today, you have to look back a little bit. And, you know, the first blockchain, and for the listeners, what a blockchain is, it's really a decentralized ledger of transactions that occur. And the very first one to operate on this was Bitcoin. And if you look at when the first Bitcoin, the white paper came out, it was October 2008. And if people recall what was happening then, that was, you know, the key time in the financial meltdown. And Bitcoin started trading in January 2009. So the genesis of it is really something that was anti-establishment. It came about at a time when there was a lot of distrust with respect to governments, with respect to financial institutions. And if you look at what was happening then, there was, you know, a lot of misrepresentation with respect to the loan packages that were floating all over the world. There was a lot of mistrust with respect to the information being delivered by the banks and the information being delivered by government. So Bitcoin, I think, was really an answer to this. Is there a way for me to send you, Dave, something of value over the internet? And the internet is really very good at copying things and providing information, but not good at sending value. And so what this initial white paper on Bitcoin was, the first blockchain, was what if we had a decentralized ledger system that was validated by computers all over the world to say, yes, this is a real transaction. Something of value was sent from Andrew to Dave, and it's validated by all these computers. We no longer need a government. We no longer need a central bank or a charter bank to validate these transactions. We can do it ourselves. And so the solution was this decentralized ledger where you had this group of computers all over the world that would validate the transaction so that if I was sending you, Dave, something of value over the internet, rather than having a bank or a central government authorize that and say, yes, that's a real transaction, so basically leaving the internet, getting validated and coming back, blockchain allows the ability for me to send you something of value. And the very first cryptocurrency to leverage off the blockchain is Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. So coming back to where we are today and to where the why the hype is there. So originally, things like Bitcoin were attractive to people in countries that, number one, were suffering from massive hyperinflation. So, you know, places like Zimbabwe, where, you know, you had hyperinflation that was increasing by about 50% a day, or places like the Ukraine or Latvia that were at risk of foreign invasion and had had so before and had lost, you know, assets. This was a place to have a storage of value where you could have, you know, own your Bitcoin through this decentralized blockchain ledger. And as long as you know your password, you can access that anywhere in the world. What's begun to happen as Bitcoin has evolved and, you know, all the rest of these cryptocurrencies is you have a vast amount of speculators that have come into the market. And as this happens and the cryptocurrencies increase, it's naturally going to intrigue the general mainstream public into coming in and investigating what's going on because the returns have been so phenomenal. I think the first Bitcoin traded for fractions of a penny. And you know, as of this morning, it was at, you know, $9,700 US. So I think anytime you have these vast gains and ability for people to make money, you're going to attract speculators. You're going to attract people that see it as a storage of value. And then there's a select group of people that use it as a form of payment. And so as that becomes mainstream, there's, I think, a driving force that makes people want to talk about it and understand it and get involved.
Okay. Now you mentioned, countries that are subjected to hyperinflation, maybe even failed states that would benefit from blockchain technology. What about Venezuela, which is, in fact, has a state-sponsored cryptocurrency of its own called the Petro? Do you have an opinion on that one way or the other?
Yeah, my view is that when you look at a place like Venezuela that has suffered from a lot of hyperinflation and maybe some distrust of government, A cryptocurrency like Bitcoin will always win. The government can try and institute their own cryptocurrency. However, it's still going to be run by the government. And if you go back to the roots of this, it is, you know, somewhat of an anti-establishment process. And so are you going to go back to trusting the government that has let you down so many times in the past, or into a global currency that is beyond the reach of government? And so from that perspective, I think what they're trying to do there will have some moderate amount of success, but it's not going to be able to deliver to the population what Bitcoin does.
Right. And when you bring in a nation state into a decentralized ledger, it sort of does defeat the purpose theoretically.
Absolutely.
But they do have something a little bit different to offer in terms of having a commodity-based coin, in this case, mining and petroleum. Does that, for the investor, does that really make any difference?
I think there's a lot of different coins out there that are backed by commodities. And so it just comes back to, do you trust the people running the coin, and is it really... You know, I guess there is a function of decentralization if it's being mined by people all over the world, but ultimately, who's controlling it?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's switch gears here for just a second. Ask you if you can elaborate right now on Hut 8 operations and what exactly the company does with the Bitcoin after you mine it.
Yeah, sure. I'll give you a little bit of background about Hut 8. So while I was an investment banker and seeing all kinds of deals coming to market, you know, some good and a lot of bad, sort of sat around with some clients and said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could put something together that was a, you know, a company of high integrity that could deliver investors exposure to Bitcoin in the public market? And the reason why that's valid is if you've ever tried to open a Bitcoin account or buy Bitcoin online, number one, it's, you know, it's about an 18-step process. You have to wire money to places like Gibraltar, and then you have to understand how to secure it. How do you buy it? What are the best exchanges? So
yes,
Hut 8 was really created as a proxy for people who wanted to have exposure to this, on the public market. So you could put into your RRSP, your TFSA, it shows up on your account, wherever you hold your broker account. And it provides an ease of access. So in sitting around with these people, we said, well, how do we do this? And they said, well, we know the guys at Bitfury, Bitfury being the second largest Bitcoin player in the world with respect to manufacturing and mining. And over the course of the next month, we put together Hut 8 through mutual due diligence. And I was one of the guys there at the very beginning that helped found the company. And that was really the history of it. So through two separate raises, we raised just under $110 million, one in December and one in February. And through an exclusive partnership with Bitfury in North America for access to all of their technology, we purchase what are called block boxes. So a block box is a 40-foot C-CAN container that it has all the chips and processors and everything inside for mining Bitcoin. And we bought these from Bitfury and dropped them down the initial group in a place called Drumheller, Alberta, which is very well known for having a great dinosaur bone museum, if you ever go. And those boxes currently have an electrical capacity of 18.7 megawatts or 128 petahash per second. So the petahash is how many quadrillion computations it does per second to mine Bitcoin. And we've also announced a deal with the city of Medicine Hat for another 42 megawatts, where we're going to drop another 40 of these mini data centers, which in total will have 428 petahashes per second. So 428 quadrillion computations per second. And that's really the basis of our operations in Canada and what we do.
I'm going to ask you on in terms of the mining operations themselves. And this is a question that I haven't really had clarity in terms of answered where exactly in terms of the usury fee that the end user is experiencing when they want a transaction between point A and point B. The idea of a decentralized system makes sense, but to me, it seems as though the mining fees and the other fees that go along with it are almost like an interest rate that you would have in typical fiat currencies. Explain to the listening audience when they're trading a single Bitcoin from point A to point B, what the real world costs are incurred during that transaction.
So the answer is twofold. So in order to do a transaction, on the Bitcoin blockchain, the transactions are lumped into a block, and blocks are mined every 10 minutes. The mining operation, the reward that comes for solving the hash, for validating that block onto the blockchain, it comes from treasury. So there's no cost to the people sending or receiving the Bitcoin. It comes from treasury and it's mined. Yes. So Bitcoin is maxed out at 21 million Bitcoin, currently at about 17 million. And the date based on the algorithm, because we know it's every 10 minutes and how much Bitcoin reward there is set to max at the 21 million in the year 2140. Not 2040, 2140. So well beyond our lifetimes. Mm-hmm. So in that way, it's deflationary because we know there'll never be more than 21 million Bitcoin. Doesn't cost anybody anything. There has been the introduction of transaction fees. And in order to understand the transaction fees, which are fairly small, it has to do with the prioritization of the transaction. So if I use Bitcoin to buy a cup of coffee, which I would never do, but somebody might, not that important that I need to get that transaction prioritized by the miners or the exchanges. But if I was doing a larger transaction, mm-hmm. The exchanges may give you the option to pay a small fee. And that those are the fees that the miners additionally earn for mining the Bitcoin. So really, it's up to the person doing the transaction. And do they want to pay a small fee in order to prioritize that transaction and get it onto the block faster?
Andrew, you've been with Hut 8 for a relatively short time. What drove you to make the move to this company?
Well, it was a very easy decision. I had been an investment banker for over 21 years and had quite enjoyed that, and was one of the people that founded Hut 8 and saw the company grow and evolve from being a concept to a company worth over $400 million. So while we were searching for a new CEO, I thought it would be a great opportunity to get in there, since I had good fit with the guys, had done the financial structuring, the fundraising, and helped put the board together.
Now, can you tell our listeners how Hut 8 entered into the partnership proxy with Bitfury, one of the world's largest producers of cryptocurrency mining equipment?
Yeah, absolutely. So we were sitting around with some of the people who turned out to be the co-founders, and we said, wouldn't it be great if there was an ability for people to get leverage to cryptocurrency in the public stock market, specifically Bitcoin, without having to go through all the complexities of opening up a hot wallet and transferring money offshore and all the other procedures involved with buying Bitcoin. And one of the other co-founders, Mark, said, hey, I know the guys at Bitfury. I met them through Richard Branson on Necker Island
at the
conference. Yeah. So that was on a Wednesday. On a Friday, he was on a plane to meet the Bitfury team in Kiev. 2 weeks later, we met with them in Washington. And then over the course of the next 30 days, we put together what is Hut 8.
Now, companies like Hut 8 they're taking the lead in developing the technology and the infrastructure for cryptocurrency mining, in concert with Bitfury. Can you explain to our audience just a little bit how this is accomplished, and what are the other possible long-term tech-based and business applications?
Sure. Well, one of the great competitive advantages that Hut 8 has is this exclusive partnership with Bitfury. So Bitfury has 500 employees. I would say probably half of them are mathematical PhDs and computer science people. So rather than Hut 8 having to go out and hire all these people and do sort of our own R&D, we can work together with the Bitfury team and say, okay, here's what we're seeing in terms of our mining facilities. Can we improve upon this? Can we improve upon this? And then they throw some very, talented people at the issue, and as well trying to improve. So that might be things like our new boxes have, increased megawatt capacity, increased petahash capacity. So they are using the same amount of electricity, but they're producing a lot more in terms of the petahashes that we have.
Oh, that's very cool. And something else that's pretty cool is the story behind the company name Hut 8. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So the original name for the company was called Bletchley Capital. So Bletchley Park, which it was named after, is the place in London where Alan Turing decoded the Enigma, the German Enigma machine. So essentially, if you've ever seen the movie The Imitation Game, it's based on this very troubled but brilliant mathematician was recruited by the British military to help decode the German military's Enigma machine, which they were using to bomb different places around the world. And Alan Turing is now credited for in this place, Hut 8, where he actually built this thing, for building the world's first computer and being sort of the godfather of AI, computing, and cryptology.
That's a great story. Now, the crypto mining business, it's getting busy out there. And with more and more multi-million dollar startups entering the industry, how does Hut 8 separate itself from this competitive field?
Yeah. And so when we put the company together, we sort of looked around and asked ourselves the same question. So, the first thing that we said was, at the time there was a huge shortage of chips all around the world, the ASIC mining chips. So, part of it with the story I told you before, when we jumped on the plane and went to go see the Bitfury guys, they said, let's lock up a partnership with someone so we get access to the chips. So check mark there. Then we sort of looked around and said, hey, there's a whole bunch of people all over the world that have these chips that sort of land on their laps if they're able to get them. and then aren't quite sure what to do with them. They tell people they do, but you know, building a data center is somewhat complicated. And so we said, well, rather than relying on ourselves to figure this out, why don't we go to the guys that have teams doing this already and outsource the servicing of this to them? And so that's why when we created the partnership with Bitfury, we said, let's remove those risks right now, which is the access to the technology and then the enabling of the technology. So that's mm-hmm. a key differentiator for us in working with guys as big as Bitfury.
Okay, now, big picture, geography, energy resources, they're now playing a huge role in crypto mining, and companies are scouring the earth looking for access to cheaper and cheaper hydroelectric power. All needed to run the thousands and thousands of computers to mine Bitcoin and other digital currencies. Can you tell us where Hut 8 is positioned here and what's the long game for the industry and its requirements for that kind of huge energy consumption?
Yeah, great question. For now, we're going to be very focused in North America. Why? That is where our exclusivity with Bitfury resides. We like Canada. It's a very, you know, obviously politically stable and a very cooperative government that's interested in the space. We have found a lot of success in Alberta. Alberta for us is a great space because there's a lot of trapped energy there. It's natural gas. And we are providing a service to a lot of the people that are, you know, have the natural gas, but really nothing to do with it because Canada has been unable to expand its pipelines to the coast, which is obviously a source of great debate in Ottawa. So the plan right now is focus on Canada. And we are also trying to focus on renewable energy. So we are in conversations with people that have the ability to provide us with hydropower and wind power. So I would say the future for us would be to focus more in the renewable side.
Gotcha. Hut 8 had a splashy launch on the TSX Venture Exchange back in early March, but it took a little bit longer than expected. What can you tell investors about your stock and its positioning right now in the crypto marketplace?
Well, I would say number one, I think we are probably the cheapest blockchain crypto company in the world right now, based on our public listing. Just by looking at the comparables, the other companies that trade in the space or the valuations that we see in the private market. So generally, I think there's a couple of metrics investors would want to focus on. One of them would be the market cap to funded megawatts. So in looking at Hut 8, we probably trade at about half of the value that other companies trade at in the market. Yet, we still have one of the strongest teams, and we've eliminated a lot of the risks that the other public companies have, such as the access to the technology and the deployment of the technology. I would also say when you look at our board, we have assembled what I would say is probably the best board for any tech company in Canada. So, you know, in putting this together, the management team and the access to the technology, and we're trading at a big discount to everybody else. That's what I would say makes us the cheapest company in the world. But, you know, your question is kind of as to why. So mm-hmm. part of it has to do because we're new. But back in, I would say, the last half of last year, 2017, especially in what I would call Q2, Q3, the demand for cryptocurrency, blockchain-related companies in the public stock markets was huge. Everybody wants them. When we did our first deal, our 250 deal, it was a $38 million deal. Not joking, we had close to $1 billion of demand from around the world. A billion, yeah, for a $38 million deal. By the time we went and did our second round, several months later, we did that at a $5 valuation. We raised $70 million at that time, and we had about $300 million of demand for that deal. So the demand, it was starting to come down in line with the price of Bitcoin. So if you remember back in December last year, Bitcoin was in the $20,000 range. By March, April, it was down to $6,500 range.
Yep.
That took a lot of wind out of the market. So today, I think it would be very difficult for any blockchain companies to get capitalized in the capital markets right now, in the public markets. So I think we were very lucky that we got through that window. We raised $108 million through our two rounds and then went through our RTO process. So there were no delays on that. That was always projected and anticipated to investors. But by the time we got public, the chill had been cast on the market. So we have traded decently well since going public. It's been about a month and a half. But people don't yet understand our valuation. And I think once people understand our valuation and they compare it to other people in the market, there's a lot of upside potential.
Okay, sounds good. Finally, Andrew, looking into the future once again, how do you see blockchain and to a lesser extent, cryptocurrency changing the world as we know it?
Yeah, so there's the potential for change is huge. It's you know, something that can redefine the way payments are done. It's the what I would call the third inflection of the digital age. Number one being the desktop computer. Number two being the internet, and I think number three is blockchain, because of the potential to touch the way all payments are done. I mean, this is why the banks are looking at this. This is why Goldman Sachs just established a Bitcoin trading desk. This is why the automakers are all trying to, you know, figure out ways to use blockchain to manage their inventory. So the blockchain, the decentralized blockchain technology does have the impact to change everything we touch over the course of the next few years. So I would look for that. The second thing I would sort of predict is more regulation. We like regulation. We think regulation makes things safer for investors. So on that side, you know, we're supportive and do talk to regulators and want them to understand what it is that we're doing. And we want protection for people against what I would call some of the bad actors that are out there right now.
Now, when you talk regulation in Canadian terms, who would you be working with?
So the type of people that we would be in contact with would be the securities regulators, so the OSC, the Ontario Securities Commission, or the BC Securities Commission, in terms of them being comfortable with what we're doing. We are part of several what I would call sort of think tanks where regulators are involved, but primarily it's the securities regulators here in Canada. We have not been asked in the U.S., but we do know a lot of people in the U.S., and the SEC there is looking at, you know, differences between what is a utility token versus what is a securities token, and how are these things reported? What investor protections are there?
Well, that sounds fantastic. I could continue on for at least another half an hour, but we do have to wrap things up. So thanks again, Andrew, for joining us today on our Stockhouse Blockchain Cryptocurrency 101 podcast. Very thought-provoking and entertaining discussion. Once again, Andrew, thanks, and have a great day.
Thank you. You too.